Simon owed his survival to pilferage from the gardens of local cotsmen. Keeping a wary eye out for dogs or angry residents, he would swoop down from the shelter of the forest to rifle the pitifully sparse vegetable patches, scraping up carrots and onions or hurriedly plucking apples from lower branches. But even these meager goods were few and far between. Often as he walked, the hunger pains were so great that he would shout out in anger, kicking savagely at the tangling shrubbery. Once he kicked so hard and screamed so loudly that when he fell down on his face in the undergrowth, he could not get up for a long time. He lay listening to the echoes of his cries disappear and thought he would die. No, life in the forest was not a tenth so glorious as he had imagined it in those long-ago hay-halt afternoons, crouching in the stables smelling hay and tack leather, listening to Shem's stories. The mighty old heart was a dark and miserly host, jealous of doling comforts out to strangers. Hiding in thorny brush to sleep away the hours of sun, making his damp, shivering way through the darkness beneath the tree-netted moon, or scuttling furtively through the garden plots in his sagging, too large cloak, Simon knew he was more rabid than rogue. Although he carried the rolled pages of Morgaini's Life of John wherever he went, clutching them like a baton of office or a priest's blessed tree, less and less often as the days passed did he actually read them. At the thin end of the day, between a pathetic meal, if any, and the frightening, close-leaning darkness of the world out of doors, he would open the bundle and read a part of a page. But every day the sense of it seemed harder to grasp. One page, on which the names of John, Aylston the Fisher King, and the dragon Shurike were prominent, caught his mayfly attention. But after he had read it through four times, struggling, he realized that it made no more sense to him than would the year lines on a piece of timber. By his fifth afternoon in the forest, he only sat, crying softly, with the pages spread on his lap. He absently stroked the smooth parchment, as he had once scratched the kitchen cat uncountable years ago, in a warm, bright room that smelled of onions and cinnamon. A week and a day out from the dragon and fisherman, he passed within shouting distance of the village of Sistan, a settlement only slightly larger than Flett. The twin clay chimneys of Sistan's roadhouse were smoking, but the road was empty, the sun bright. Simon peered down a hillside from the clump of silvery birches, and the memory of his last hot meal struck him like a physical blow, weakening his knees so that he almost fell. That long-lost evening, despite its conclusion, seemed almost like Dr. Morgaini's one-time description of the pagan paradise, of the old Rimmersgarders, eternal drinking and storytelling, merrymaking without end. He crept down the hill toward the quiet roadhouse, hands trembling, forming wild plans of stealing a meat pie from an unguarded windowsill, or slipping in a back door to pillage the kitchen. He was out of the trees and halfway down the slope, when he suddenly realized what he was doing. Walking out of the woods at unshadowed noon, a sickened, feverish animal that had lost its self-protective instincts. Feeling suddenly naked despite his bramble-studded wool cloak, he froze in place, then whirled and scrambled away, back up to the swan-slim birch trees. Now even they seemed too exposed. Cursing and sobbing, he clambered past to the thicker shadows, drawing old heart around him like a cloak. 5 days west of Sistan, the begrimed and famished youth found himself crouched on another slope, peering down into a forest dell at a rough, split-log hut. He was sure as he could be with his thoughts so piteously scattered and fragmented, that another day without real food or another solitary night spent in the chill, uncaring forest would leave him really and finally deranged. He would become completely the beast he more and more frequently felt himself to be. His thoughts were turning foul and brutish. Food, dark hiding places, weary forest tramping, these were his all-consuming preoccupations. It was increasingly difficult to remember the castle. Had it been warm there? Had people spoken to him? and when a branch had lanced his tunic and scored his ribs the day before, he had only been able to growl and flail at it. A beast. Somebody lives here. The woodsman's cottage had a front path lined with tidy stones. A stack of halved timbers nestled beneath the eaves against the side wall. Surely, he reasoned, sniffling quietly, surely somebody here would take pity on him if he walked to the door and calmly asked for some food. I'm so hungry. It's not fair. It's not right. Somebody must feed me. Somebody. He went slowly down the hill on stiff legs, his mouth gaping open and closed. A flagging recollection of the social contract told him that he must not frighten these rustic people, these suspicious woodsfolk in their tree-tiered hollow. He held his empty palms before him as he walked, pale fingers thrust wide apart in a dumb show of harmlessness. The cottage was empty, or at least the inhabitants were simply not responding to his sore-knuckled knocking. He walked around the little hut, dragging his fingertips along the rough wood. The single window was shuttered with a wide plank. He rapped again, harder. Only hollow echoes answered. As he sank into a crouch beneath the boarded window, wondering desperately if he could batter it open with a piece of firewood, a rustling, snapping noise from the stand of trees before him brought him back upright so quickly that his vision momentarily narrowed to a core of light surrounded by blackness. He wavered, feeling sick. The tree fence bulged outward as though struck by a huge hand, then sprang back with a quiver. A moment later, the silence was skewered again, this time by a strange staccato hiss. The noise was transmuted into a rapid stream of words, in no language that Simon knew, but words nonetheless. After a percussive instant, the glade was quiet again. Simon was stone-struck. He could not move. What should he do? Perhaps the cottager had been attacked by an animal on his way home. Simon could help him. Then they would have to give him food. But how could he help? He could barely walk. And what if it was a beast, only a beast? What if he had only imagined hearing words in that abrupt spatter of sound? And what if it was something worse? The king's guardsmen with bright, sharp swords, or a starvation, slender, white-haired witch? Perhaps it was the very devil himself, with ember-red robes and nightshade eyes. Where he found the courage, even the strength, to unbend his rigid knees and walk forward into the trees, Simon could not say. If he had not felt so ill and so desperate, he might not have. But he was ill, and starved, and as dirty and lonely as a Nasgardu jackal. Wrapping his cloak tightly about his chest, holding the fur of Morgani's writings before him, he limped toward the copse. In the trees, the sunlight fell unevenly, strained through a sieve of spring leaves, dotting the forest floor like a scatter of fitting pieces. The air seemed taut as held breath. For a moment he saw nothing but dark tree shapes and slivers of lancing daylight. In one spot the shafts of light were jigging fitfully. He realized a moment later that they shone on a struggling figure. As he took a step forward, the leaves whispered beneath his foot, and with that sound the struggling ceased. The hanging thing, it dangled fully a yard off the spongy ground, lifted its head and stared at him. It had the face of a man, but the merciless topaz eyes of a cat. Simon leaped back, his heart tipping in his chest. He flung out his hands, fingers spread wide as though to block out the sight of this bizarre gallows bird. Whatever or whoever he was not like any man Simon had seen. Still, there was something achingly familiar about him, as from a half-remembered dream. But so many of Simon's dreams were now bad ones. What a strange apparition. Although caught in a cruel trap, pinioned at waist and elbows by a noose of snaky black rope, and hanging from a bobbing branch out of reach of the earth, still this prisoner looked fierce, unhumbled, a treed fox who would die with his teeth in a hound's throat. If he was a man, he was a very slender man. His high-cheeked, thin-boned face reminded Simon for a moment, a horrifyingly cold moment, of the black-robed creatures on Thistleborg, But where they had been pale, white-skinned as blind fish, this one was golden brown, like polished oak. Trying to get a better look in the dim light, Simon took a step forward. The prisoner narrowed his eyes, then skinned back his lips, baring his teeth in a feline hiss. Something in the way he did it, something inhuman about the way his quite human face moved, told Simon in an instant that this was no man trapped here like a weasel. This was something different. Simon had moved closer than was prudent, and as he stared into the flecked amber eyes, the prisoner lashed out, bringing cloth-booted feet up into the youth's ribcage. Simon, though he had seen the momentary backswing and anticipated the assault, still received a painful blow in the side, so swift was the prisoner's movement. He stumbled back, glowering at his attacker, who scowled horribly in return. As he faced the stranger across the span of a man's height, Simon watched the somehow unnatural muscles draw the mouth open in a sneer. And the scythe, for Simon had realized suddenly, as if someone had told him that this hanging creature was exactly that. The scythe spat out a single awkward word in Simon's westerling tongue.
Coward!
Simon was so angered by this that he nearly charged forward, starvation and fear and aching limbs notwithstanding, until he realized that this was just what the Scyther's oddly accented jibe had been meant to accomplish. Simon pushed down the pain of his kicked ribs, folded his hands over his chest, and stared at the trapped Scyther man. He had the grim satisfaction of seeing what he felt sure was a squirm of frustration. The fair one, as Rachel had always superstitiously referred to the race, wore a strange, soft robe and pants of a slithery brown material, only a shade darker than his skin. Belt and ornaments of shiny green stone contrasted most wonderfully with his hair, lavender blue like mountain heather, pulled back close against his head by a bone ring, dangling in a horsetail behind one ear. He seemed only slightly shorter, although much thinner than Simon. But the youth had not seen himself recently in any reflection but murky forest pools. Perhaps now he too looked this scrawny and wild. But even so, still there were differences, not quite definable things. Bird-like motions of the head and neck, an odd fluidity in the pivoting of joints, an aura of power and control that was discernible even while its possessor hung like an animal in the crudest of traps. This scythe, this dream haunter, was unlike anything Simon had known. He was terrifying and thrilling. He was alien.
"I don't want to hurt you," Simon said at last, and realized he was speaking as though to a child. "I didn't set the trap."
The Scyther continued to regard him with baleful, crescent eyes.
"What terrible pain he must be hiding," Simon marveled. "His arms are pulled up so far that I would be screaming if it were me."
Protruding above the prisoner's left shoulder was a quiver, empty but for two arrows. Several more arrows and a bow of slim dark wood lay strewn on the turf beneath his dangling feet.
"If I try to help you, will you promise not to hurt me?"
Simon asked, forming his words slowly.
"I'm very hungry myself," he lamely added.
The Scyther said nothing, but as Simon took another step, he coiled his legs up before him to kick. The youth retreated.
"Be damned," Simon shouted. "I only want to help you."
But why did he? Why let the wolf out of the pit?
"You must..."
he began, but the rest of his words were snuffed out as a large dark form came swishing and crackling out of the trees toward them.
"Ah, here it be, here it be," a deep voice said. A man, bearded and dirty, waded into the little clearing. His clothes were heavy and much mended. In his hand, he swung an axe.
"Now then, you..."
He stopped when he saw Simon, huddled against a tree.
"Here," he growled. "Who be you? What are you about?"
Simon looked down at the pitted axe blade.
"I'm... I'm just a traveller. I heard a noise here in the trees.
He waved his hand toward the odd tableau.
I found him here, in this trap.
My trap, the woodsman grinned. My damn trap. And there he be, too.
Turning his back on Simon, the man looked the dangling scyther over coolly.
I promised I'd stop their sneaking and spying and souring the milk. That I did.
He reached out a hand and pushed the prisoner's shoulder, swinging him helplessly back and forth in a slow arc. The scyther hissed, but it was an impotent sound. The woodsman laughed.
By the tree, they got fight in 'em, they do. God, fight.
What are you going to do with him?
What do you think, boy? What do you think God'd have us do with sprites and imps and devils when we catch 'em? Send 'em back to hell with my good chopper. That'll tell you.
The prisoner slowly stopped swinging, revolving in a lazy circle at the end of the black rope like a webbed fly. His eyes were downcast, his body limp.
Kill him?
Simon, ill and weak as he was, still felt a cold wash of shock. He tried to marshal his straggling thoughts.
You're going to... But you can't! You can't! He's a...
What he's not is no natural creature, that's sure. Get away from here, stranger. You're in my bit of garden, as it were, and you got no call to be. I know what these creatures are a-getting up to.
The woodsman contemptuously turned his back on Simon and moved toward the scyther, axe raised as though to split timber. This timber, though, suddenly heaved, became a struggling, kicking, snarling beast fighting for its life. The Cotsman's first blow went awry, grazing the bony cheek and digging a jagged furrow down the arm of the strange, shiny garment. A ribbon of all-too-human-looking blood dribbled down the slender jaw and neck. The man advanced again. Simon dropped down to his sore knees, looking for something to stop this ghastly struggle, to halt the man's grunting and cursing, and the scratchy snarl of the beleaguered prisoner that punished his ears. Groping, he found the bow, but it was even lighter than it had looked, as though strung on marsh reed. An instant later, his hand closed on a half-buried rock. He heaved, and it broke free from the clinging soil. He held it over his head.
Stop! He shouted. Leave him be!
Neither combatant gave him a flicker of notice. The woodsman now stood at arm's length, swiping at his swirling target, landing only glancing blows but continuing to draw blood. The scyther's thin chest was heaving like a bellows. He was weakening quickly. Simon could not stand the cruel spectacle any longer. Setting free the howl that had been coiling itself within him through all the interminable, terrifying days of his exile, he sprang forward, crossing the tiny clearing in a bound, to bring the rock down on the back of the Cotsman's head. A dull smack reverberated through the trees. The man seemed to go boneless in an instant. He pitched heavily forward onto his knees, and then his face, a surge of red welling up through his matted hair. Staring down at the bloody wreckage, Simon felt his insides heave. He fell to his knees, retching, bringing up nothing but a sour strand of spittle. He pressed his dizzy head against the damp ground and felt the forest sway and rock about him. When he was able, he stood and turned to the scythy man, who again dangled quietly in the noose. The snaky tunic was laced with streamers of blood, and the feral eyes were dimmed as though some internal curtain had rolled down to block the light within. As haltingly as a sleepwalker, Simon picked up the fallen axe and traced the taut rope up from the prisoner to where it wrapped around a high limb of the tree, a limb too high to reach. Simon, too numb for fear, worked the nicked blade edge against the knot behind the scyther's back. The fair one winced as the noose pulled tighter, but made no sound. After a long moment of scraping and rubbing, the slippery knot parted. The scyther fell to the ground, legs buckling, and tumbled forward onto the motionless woodsman. He rolled away from the mute hulk immediately, as though burned, and began gathering up his scattered arrows. holding them like a clutch of long-stemmed flowers. He picked up his bow in the other hand and paused to stare at Simon. His cold eyes glinted, stopping the words in Simon's mouth. For an instant the Scyther, injuries forgotten or ignored, stood poised and tense as a startled deer. Then he was gone, a flash of brown and green that vanished into the trees, leaving Simon gape-jawed and deserted. The spotted sunlight had not finished rippling on the leaves where he had passed, when Simon heard a buzz like an angry insect and felt a shadow flit across his face. An arrow stood out from a tree trunk beside him, quivering gradually back into visibility, less than an arm's length from his head. He stared at it, dully, wondering when the next one would strike him. It was a white arrow, shaft and feathers alike bright as a gull's wing. He waited for its inevitable successor. None came. The stand of trees was silent and motionless. After the strangest and most terrible fortnight of his life, and after a particularly bizarre day, it should not have surprised Simon to hear a new and unfamiliar voice speaking to him from the darkness beyond the trees. A voice that was not the Scyther's, and certainly did not come from the woodsman, who lay like a felled tree.
"Got a head to take it," the voice said. "The arrow. Take it. It is yours."
Simon should not have been surprised, but he was. He dropped helplessly to the ground and began to cry. Great choking sobs of exhaustion and confusion and total despair.
"Oh, daughter of the mountains," the strange new voice said. "This does not seem good."
Chapter 17. Binnabik. When Simon at last looked up to the source of the new voice, his tearful eyes widened in surprise. A child was walking toward him. No, not a child, but a man so small that the top of his black-haired head would probably not reach much higher than Simon's navel. His face did have something of the childish about it. The narrow eyes and wide mouth both stretched toward the cheekbones in an expression of simple good humor.
"This is not a good place for crying," the stranger said.
He turned from kneeling Simon to briefly survey the fallen cotsman.
"It is also my feeling that it will not accomplish much, at least for this dead fellow."
Simon wiped his nose on the sleeve of his coarse shirt and hiccuped. The stranger had moved forward to examine the pale arrow, which stood from the tree trunk near Simon's head like a stiff ghost branch.
"You should take this," the little man said,
and again his mouth widened in a froggy smile, bearing for an instant a palisade of yellow teeth. He was not a dwarf, like the fools and tumblers Simon had seen at court and in the main row of Urchester. Although big-chested, he seemed otherwise well-proportioned. His clothes looked much like a Rimmer's man's. Jacket and leggings of some thick animal hide, stitched with sinew, a fur collar turned up below his round face. A large skin bag hung bulging from a shoulder strap, and he held a walking stick that looked to be carved from some long, slender bone.
"Please excuse my suggestions, but you should be taking this arrow. It is a seedy white arrow, and it is very precious. It signifies a debt, and the Scythi are conscientious folk."
"Who are you?" Simon asked around another hiccup. He was wrung out, beaten flat like a shirt pounded dry on a rock. If this little man had come out of the trees snarling and waving a knife, he did not think he could have reacted any differently.
"Me?"
the stranger asked, pausing as though giving the question much thought.
"A traveller, like yourself. I will be happy to explain more things at a later time, but now we should go. This fellow,"
he indicated the woodsman with a sweep of his stick,
"will reliably not become more alive, but he may have friends or family who will be unsettled to find him so extremely dead. Please, Take the white arrow and come with me.
Mistrustful and wary, Simon nevertheless found himself rising to his feet. It was too much effort to not trust for the moment. He no longer had the strength to stay on guard. A part of him wanted only to lie down and quietly die. He levered the arrow loose from the tree. The tiny man was already on the march, climbing back up the hillside above the cottage. The little house crouched as silently and tidily as if nothing had happened. But Simon gasped as he scrambled up after the stranger, who moved with surprising quickness.
But what about the cottage? I am so hungry. And there might be food.
The small man turned on the hill crest to stare down at the struggling youth.
I am very shocked, he said. First, you make him dead, then you wish to rob his ladder. I fear I have fallen in with a desperate outlaw.
He turned and continued into the close-knit trees. The far side of the crest was a long, gradual downslope. Simon's limping strides finally brought him abreast of the stranger. In a few moments, he had caught his breath.
Who are you? And where are we going?
The strange little man did not look up, but kept his eyes moving from tree to tree, as though looking for some landmark in the unremitting sameness of the deep woods. After 20 silent paces, he turned his eyes up to Simon's and pulled his stretchy smile.
My name is Binbineke Kabenik, he said. But around the cookfire, I am called Binapik. I hope you will honor me by using the shorter version of friendship.
I will. Where are you from?
He hiccuped again.
I am of the troll folk of Yikanok,
Binapik replied.
Hi, Yikanok, in the snowing and blowing northern mountains. And you are?
He stared suspiciously for a moment before answering.
Simon. Simon of the... of Urchester.
This was all happening rather quickly, he thought. Like a marketplace meeting, but in the middle of a forest after a bizarre slaying. Holy Osiris, did his head hurt. And his stomach, too.
Where are we going?
To my camp. But first I must find my mount. Or rather, she must find me. Please, do not be startled.
So saying, Binapik put two fingers in his wide mouth and blew a long, trilling note. After a moment, he did it again.
Remember, do not be startled or anxious.
Before he could ponder the troll's words, there was a crackle like wildfire in the underbrush. A moment later, a huge wolf burst into the clearing, bounding past a shocked Simon to leap like a shaggy thunderbolt onto little Binapik, who tumbled end over end beneath his growling attacker.
Kantaka!
The troll's cry was muffled, but there was amusement in his voice. Master and mount continued to wrestle across the forest floor. Simon distractedly wondered if the world outside the castle was always like this. Was the entirety of Ostenard but a playing field for monsters and lunatics? Binapik at last sat up, Kantaka's great head cradled in his lap.
I have left her alone all the day today,
he explained.
Wolves have much affection, and they become easily lonely.
Kantaka grinned hugely and panted. Much of her girth was heavy gray fur, but still she was immense.
Make yourself free,
Binapik laughed.
Scratch upon her nose.
Despite the continuing unreality of his situation, Simon did not yet feel quite ready for that. Instead, he asked,
I'm sorry, but did you say you had food at your camp, sir?
The troll clambered to his feet, laughing, and retrieved his stick.
Not sir, Binapik. And as for food, yes, we will eat together, you, I, even Kantaka. Come along, being deferential to your weak and hungry feeling, I will walk and not ride.
Simon and the troll were on the march for some time. Kantaka accompanied them for stretches, but more often trotted ahead, disappearing in a few bounds into the dense undergrowth. Once she came back licking her muzzle with her long pink tongue.
Well, Binnebik said cheerfully, one is fed already.
At last, when it seemed to the aching, dragging Simon that he could walk no farther, when he lost the thread of Binnebik's every sentence within a couple of words, they reached a little dell, empty of tree trunks, but roofed overhead with a lattice of intertwined branches. Beside a fallen log lay a ring of blackened stones. Kantaka, who had been pacing along beside them, bounded ahead to make a sniffing circuit of the dingo.
Bojo chikno kunkok, as my people say.
Binnebik made an expansive gesture around the clearing.
If the bears do not eat you, it is home.
He led Simon to a log. The youth collapsed, breathing heavily. The troll looked him up and down with concern.
Oh, Binnebik said, you are not going to be crying again, are you?
No, Simon smiled weakly. His bones felt cumbersome as dead stone. I don't think so. I'm just very hungry and tired. I promise not to cry.
Look, you, I shall make a fire. Then I shall produce a supper.
Binnebik swiftly gathered a pile of sticks and twigs, hayricking them in the middle of the ring of stones.
These are spring wood and damp, he said. But luckily, that is a matter easily dealt with.
Sliding the skin bag from his shoulder, the troll placed it on the ground and began to rummage determinedly through it. To Simon in his fatigue-born whimsy, the small squatting figure looked more than ever like that of a child. Binnebik stared into his sack with lips pursed and eyes narrowed in concentration, a six-year-old studying a limping beetle with high seriousness.
Ha!
Said the troll at last.
It is found!
He pulled from the sack a smaller sack, about the size of Simon's thumb. Binnebik took a pinch of some powdery substance from it and sprinkled it on the green wood, then took two pieces of stone from his belt and struck them together. The spark that leaped down sputtered for a moment, then a slender curl of yellow smoke spiraled up. A moment later the wood puffed into flame, and within instants it was a merry, crackling fire. The pulsing warmth lulled Simon, despite the pangs of his empty stomach. His head was nodding, nodding. But wait, a rush of fear swept over him. How could he just fall asleep, all unguarded, in a stranger's camp?
Sit and be warm, friend Simon.
Binnebik dusted off his hands as he stood.
I will return very quickly.
Although a deep unease was fighting to make itself known in the back of his thoughts, where was the troll going to get confederates, fellow bandits? Still, Simon could not muster the effort to watch Binnebik leave. His eyes were again fixed on the wavering flames. The tongues like the petals of some shimmering flower, a fire poppy quivering in a warm summer wind. He awakened from a great cloudy emptiness, to find the grey wolf's massive head lying across his thighs. Binnebik crouched over the fire, fussing at some project. Simon felt there was something slightly wrong about having a wolf in one's lap, but could not find the proper puppet strings in his mind to do anything about it. It didn't seem truly important anyway. The next time he woke, Binnebik was shooing Kantaka from his lap to offer him a large cup of something warm.
It is cool enough for drinking, the troll said,
and helped Simon raise the vessel to his lips. The broth was musky and delicious, tangy as the smell of autumn leaves. He drank it all. It seemed he could feel it flowing directly into his veins, the molten blood of the forest, warming and filling him with the secret strength of trees. Binnebik gave him a second cupful, and he drank that too. A dense, leaden clutch of worry at the juncture of his neck and shoulders melted away, swept aside by the rush of good feelings. A new airiness coursed through him, bringing with it a paradoxical heaviness, a warm, diffuse drowsiness. As he slipped away, he heard his own cradled heartbeat, muffled though it was in the tickling wool of exhaustion. Simon was almost certain that when he came to Binnevik's camp, it had been at least an hour short of sunset. But when he opened his eyes again, the forest glade was bright with new-smithed morning. As he blinked, he felt the last strands of dream pulling free. A bird? A bright-eyed bird in a sun-catching golden collar. An old, strong bird whose eyes were full of the wisdom of high places and broad vision. From his chitinous claw hung a beautiful, rainbow-shimmering fish. Simon shivered, pulling his heavy cloak nearer about him. As he stared up at the overarching trees, their budding spring leaves picked out by the sun in emerald filigree, he heard a moaning sound and rolled over on his side to look. Binnevik sat cross-legged beside the fire pit, swaying gently from side to side. Before him, an assortment of odd, pale shapes was spread on a flat rock. Bones. The troll was making the unusual noise. Was he singing? Simon stared for a moment, but could not puzzle out what the little man might be doing. What a strange world. Good morning, he said at last. Binnevik jumped guiltily.
Ah, it is friend Simon.
The troll grinned over his shoulder and quickly swept the objects into his open skin bag, then stood up and hastened to Simon's side.
How are you now feeling? He asked,
bending over to place a small rough hand on Simon's forehead.
You must have needed a great sleep.
I did.
Simon moved closer to the small fire.
What's that smell?
A pair of wood pigeons who have stopped to dine with us this morning.
Binnevik smiled, pointing out two leaf-wrapped bundles in the coals at the edge of the campfire.
Keeping their company are some berries and nuts recently gathered. I would have been waking you up soon to help entertain them all. They are very good tasting, I think. Oh, a moment, please.
Binnevik walked back to his skin bag, drawing forth two thin packages.
Here.
He handed them across.
Your arrow. And something else.
That was Morgani's papers.
You had placed them in your belt, and I feared they would then be broken when you were sleeping.
Suspicion flared in Simon's breast. The idea of someone handling the doctor's writings while he slept made him covetous, distrustful. He snatched the proffered bundle from the troll's hand and replaced it in his belt. The little man's cheerful look changed to one of dismay. Simon felt ashamed, although one couldn't be too careful, and took the arrow, which had been wound in thin cloth, more gently.
Thank you, he said stiffly. Binnevik's expression was still that of a man whose kindness had been scorned.
Guilty and confused, Simon unwrapped the arrow. Although he had not yet had a chance to study it closely, at the moment he was most concerned with finding something to do with his hands and eyes. The arrow was not painted, as Simon had assumed. Rather, it was carved from some wood as white as birch bark, and fletched with snow-white feathers. Only the arrowhead, carved from some milky blue stone, had any color. Simon hefted it, weighing its surprising lightness against its amazing flexibility and solidity. And the memory of the day before came back in a rush. He knew he could never forget the feline eyes and disturbingly swift movements of the sither. All the stories that Morgani's had told were true. All along the shaft of the arrow, slender walls, curlicues, and dots were pressed into the wood with infinite care. It's all thick with carvings, Simon mused aloud.
They are very important things, the troll replied,
and shyly reached out his hand.
Please, if I may.
Simon felt another wash of guilt and quickly handed him the arrow. Binnevik tilted it back and forth, catching the sunlight and firelight just so.
This is an old fellow.
He squinted his narrow eyes until the dark pupils disappeared altogether.
It has been around for quite some long time. You are the holder now of a quite honorable thing, Simon. The white arrow is not given in lightness. It seems that this one was affletched in Tumete, a city stronghold long since gone below the blue ice, east of my homeland.
How do you know all that? Simon asked. Can you read those letters?
Some. And there are things an eye that is trained can see.
Simon took it back, handling it with a good deal more care than before. But what should I do with it? You said it was payment for a debt?
No, friend. It is a mark of a debt that is owing. And what you should be doing is to keep it safe. If it has nothing else to be, it will be a beautiful thing to look on.
A thin mist still clung to the clearing and forest floor beyond. Simon propped the arrow point downward against the log and slid closer to the fire. Binnebik pulled the pigeons from the embers, pincering with a pair of sticks. He put one bundle down on the warm rock before Simon's knees.
Remove the faulted leaves, the troll instructed. Then wait for a short passing time, so the bird will slightly cool.
It was very difficult to obey the last, but somehow Simon managed. How did you get these? He asked at one point, mouth full and fingers sticky with grease.
Later, I will show you,
the troll replied. Binnebik was picking his teeth with a bowed rib bone. Simon leaned back against the log and belched contentedly.
Mother Elysia, that was wonderful,
he sighed, feeling for the first time in a long while that the world was not an entirely hostile place. A little food in your stomach changes everything.
I am glad your cure was so simple for effecting,
the troll smiled around the slender bone. Simon patted his middle.
I don't care about anything right this moment.
His elbow brushed the arrow, which began to topple. As he caught it and straightened it, a flicker of memory came to him.
I don't even feel bad anymore about that man yesterday.
Binnebik turned his brown eyes to Simon. Although he continued to probe his teeth, his forehead creased above the bridge of his nose.
You do not feel bad about him being dead or about making him dead?
I don't understand, said Simon. What do you mean? What's the difference?
There is as much difference as between a big rock and a little bug. But I shall leave the pondering to you.
But,
Simon was confused again.
Well, but he was a bad man.
Binnebik nodded his head, but the gesture carried no suggestion of agreement.
This world is certainly filling itself with bad men. Of that, there can be no doubts.
He would have killed the Sitha man.
That is also a truth.
Simon stared sullenly at the plundered heap of bird bones piled before him on the rock.
I don't understand. What do you want me to tell you?
Where it is that you are going to.
The troll tossed his toothpick into the fire and stood up. He was so small.
What?
Simon stared suspiciously as the import of the little man's words caught up at last.
I wish to know where you are going, so that perhaps we can be traveling together for a while.
Binnebik spoke slowly and patiently, as though to a beloved but stupid old dog.
I think that perhaps the sun is too young in the sky for the other questions to be troubled with. We trolls say, make philosophy your evening guest, but do not let her stay the night. Now, if my question is not of a too much inquiring nature, where do you go to?
Simon rose, knees stiff as unoiled hinges. Again he felt doubt. Could the little man's curiosity really be as innocent as it seemed? He had made the mistake of trusting at least once already, with that damnable monk.
But what choice did he have? He did not have to tell the troll everything, and it was certainly preferable to have a companion versed in woodcraft. The little man seemed to know just what to do, and suddenly Simon longed to have someone to rely on again. "I'm going north," he said, and then took a calculated risk. "To Naglamund." He watched the troll carefully. "And yourself?" Binnebik was packing his few implements into his shoulder bag.
"Ultimately, I expect to be traveling far north,"
he replied without looking up.
"It seems that we have a coincidence of paths."
Now he raised his dark eyes.
"How strange that you should be traveling toward the Naglamund, which stronghold's name I have heard much in recent weeks."
His lips quirked in a tiny secret smile. "You have?" Simon had picked up the white arrow and tried to look studiously unconcerned as he pondered how to carry it. "Where?"
"Time there will be for talking as we take to the road."
The troll grinned, a full, friendly, yellow grin.
"I must call Kantaka, who is without doubt spreading horror and despair among the rodents of this vicinity. Feel yourself welcome to empty your bladder now, so that we may swiftly walk."
Simon had to hold the white arrow between clenched teeth as he followed Binnebik's advice. Chapter 18. A Net of Stars. Blistered, sore-footed, and clothed in rags, Simon nevertheless felt the pall of despair begin to lift a little. Both mind and body were badly bruised by mischance, and he had developed a startled eye and reflexive flinch, neither of which escaped the sharp gaze of his new companion. But the brooding horror had been pushed back a short way. It had become for the moment just another painful half-memory. The unexpected companionship helped to ease the ache of lost friends and lost home, at least to the extent that he allowed it. A large secret part of his thoughts and feelings he continued to hold back. He was still suspicious, and also unwilling to invest again and risk further loss. As they trekked through the cool, bird-trilling halls of the morning forest, Binnebik explained to Simon that he had come down from his lofty home of Yikanuk, as he apparently did once a year, on business, a series of errands that carried him to Eastern Hernestia and Erkinland. Simon gathered that it involved some sort of trading.
"But, oh, my young friend, what disturbances I find this springtide. Your peoples are very upset, very frightened."
Binnebik waved his hands in mock agitation.
"In the outlying provinces, the king is not popular, is he? And they are fearful of him in Hernestia. Elsewhere there is anger, and there is starving. People are afraid to travel. The roads are no longer safe." "Well," he grinned, "if you wish truth to be told, the roads never were safe, at least in the areas of isolation. But it is real that there is a change for the worse in the north of Osten-Ard."
Simon was observing how the noon sun had set vertical columns of light among the tree trunks. "Have you ever traveled to the south?" he asked at last.
"If by south you mean south of Erkinland, my answering is yes, once or twice. But please remember, among my people, almost any leaving of Yikanuk is travel to the south."
Simon was not paying very close attention.
"Did you travel by yourself? Did Kantaka go with you?"
Binnebik wrinkled another smile.
"No. It was long ago, before my wolf friend was born. When I was..."
How did you get this wolf?" Simon interrupted.
Binnebik gave an exasperated hiss.
"It is a difficult thing, answering questions, when one is having continual interruptions with more questions."
Simon tried to look penitent, but he was feeling the spring as a bird feels wind in its feathers.
"Sorry,"
he said. I've been told before, by a friend, that I ask too many questions.
It is not too many,
Binnabik said, using his stick to push a low-hanging branch away from their path.
It is piled on top of one and another.
The troll barked a short laugh.
Now, which do you want for my answering?
Oh, whichever you want. You decide, Simon replied meekly, then jumped as the troll smacked him lightly on the wrist with his walking stick.
It would please me you're not being obsequious. That is a trait of marketplace people who are selling shoddy goods. I am sure to prefer endless stupid questions to that. Obsequious. Flattering with oiliness. It is not liked by me. In Yikanok we say, send the man with the oily tongue to go and lick the snowshoes.
What does that mean?
It means that we do not like flatterers. Never mind, then.
Binnabik threw back his head and laughed, black hair swinging, eyes nearly disappearing as his round cheeks rose toward his brows.
Never mind. We have wandered as far as the wandering of lost Picky Peg. Wandered in our conversing, I mean. No, do not ask anything. We will stop here for a rest, and I will tell you now about how I met my friend, Kantaka.
They chose a huge stone. An outcropping of granite thrusting up from the forest floor like a speckled fist, its upper half painted by a swath of sunlight. The young man and the troll climbed up to perch on top. The forest was silent around them. The dust of their passage slowly settled. Binnabik reached into his bag and produced a stick of dried meat and a goatskin of thin, sour wine. As Simon chewed, he kicked off his shoes and wiggled his sore toes in the warming sun. Binnabik looked at the shoes critically.
We shall have to be finding something else.
He poked the tattered, blackened leather.
A man's soul is in peril when his feet are hurting.
Simon grinned at this thought. They spent a while in silent contemplation of the surrounding forest, the living greenery of Old Heart.
Well, said the troll at last, the first thing that needs understanding is that my people do not shun the wolf. Although we are not usually having friendships with them either. Trolls and wolves have lived side by side for many thousands of years, and we are leaving each other alone most times. Our neighbors, if so polite a term can be used, the hairy men of the Rimasgard, think the wolf a dangerous animal of great treachery. You are familiar with the men of Rimasgard?
Oh, yes, Simon was pleased to be in the know. They were all about in the he caught himself, in Urchester. I have talked to many of them. They wear their beards long, he added, demonstrating his familiarity.
Well, since we live in the high mountains, we cannot, we trolls, and we do not kill these wolves. The Rimmer's men think we are wolf demons. In their frost-crazy, blood-feuding brains,
Binnabik put on a look of comical disgust.
It is their thought that troll folk are magical and evil. There have been bloody fights, very many, many, between Rimmer's men, Crowhawk, we call them, and my Canuck folk.
I'm sorry, said Simon, thinking guiltily of the admiration he had felt for old Duke Iskrenlaw, who on reflection did not seem like the type to massacre innocent trolls, testy though he was reputed to be.
Sorry? You should not be. Now myself, I am thinking that men and women of Rimasgard are clumsy, stupid, and suffer with excessive dullness. But I do not think they are then evil, are deserving of being made dead.
Ah, he sighed, shaking his head like a philosopher priest in a dead-end tavern.
Rimmer's men are a puzzlement to me.
But what about the wolves? Simon asked.
then silently chided himself for interrupting. This time, Binnebik did not seem to mind.
My people live on Craggy Minterhawk, in the mountains called Trollfells, by the Rimmer's Men. We ride the shaggy, nimble-footed rams, raising them up from tiny lambkins, until they have enough bigness to bear us through the mountain passes. There is nothing, Simon, that is in this world quite like being a ram rider of Yikanok, to sit your steed, to be wending the pathways of the roof of the world, to be leaping in a single bound of greatness across mountain chasms so very deep, so exquisitely deep, that if a rock was dropped by you, it would take half a day to strike bottom.
Binnebik smiled and squinted in happy reverie. Simon, trying to visualize such heights, suddenly felt a little dizzy and put his palms flat on the reassuring stone. He looked down. This perch, at least, stood only a man's height above the earth.
Kintaka was a pup when she was found by me,
Binnebik continued at last.
Her mother had been probably killed, or from starvation had died. She snarled at me when I discovered her, a ball of white fur, given away in the snow by Black Nose.
He smiled.
Yes, she is gray now. Wolves, like people are doing, often change their colors as they grow. I found myself touched by her effort at defending. I brought her back with me. My master,
Binnebik paused. The harsh cry of a jay filled the moment.
My master said if I would be taking her from the arms of Kintipa the Snow Maiden, then I was assuming duties of a parent.